Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/filmwaxradio. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Hello, everybody. My name is Adam Shartoff, and I'll be your host this evening for episode number 355 of the podcast. Today's guests include experimental filmmaker. I don't know, is that too narrow a description? Possibly, because she makes documentaries, she's made short form, she's made experimental. I mean, she's been working for decades and making all sorts of different films. Her name is Beth B. She was part of the No Wave underground scene in New York City back in the 70s into the 80s, and she has made a documentary about her mother, and it's called Call Me Apple Brug. Her mother is an artist well into her 80s, and the two have had an interesting relationship over the years. It's complex, you know, as most relationships between artistic people can be. So here today on the show, Beth B., who was terrific. I really enjoyed talking with her. Again, her new film is called Call Her Apple Brug, which will have a theatrical run here in New York City starting this Friday at the Metrograph Theater in Lower East Side of Manhattan. So I know that Beth and her mother, Ida, will be doing a Q&A on Friday, maybe even more. I guess, the Metrograph website and get more details about that. And then we're bringing back to the show Bill Plimpton. If you go to plimptoons.com, you can watch right now. Well, wait till you hear the show. Then you can watch Bill's new film right on his website. Free for his fans. And free for those who are not his fans. All you have to do is get an internet and type plimptoons.com on it. And then you can watch Hitler's Folly, which is a mockumentary. And which Bill and I will discuss in just a little while on this very show. But first, guess who I have on the show? Oscar-winning documentary filmmaker Leon Gast makes an appearance. Leon directed a documentary some 20 years ago. It's called When We Were Kings, and it was all about Muhammad Ali and the rumble in the jungle. It was in 1974, and it was perhaps the most famous heavyweight championship boxing match of all time. And it was took place in Kinshasa, Zaire. And Leon Gast made a documentary about it. It ended up winning the Oscar for Best Documentary. You can see this on YouTube, actually. And if you go there, you know, you'll see Leon and his producing partner at the time to accept their Oscar. And then they bring up Muhammad Ali and George Foreman to the stage. It's remarkable. At that point, Ali, well along in his Parkinson's, but he could still manage to walk. And so he got up to the stage pretty well. And anyway, it was a pretty remarkable experience. Well, Muhammad Ali, of course, as we all know, passed away just days ago. And when I posted the last show, I did mention maybe what I'm going to try to do is contact Leon and see if I can't get through. And maybe he'll do the podcast. So he did agree to it. And we were at the Showbiz Studios. And I got Leon on the show. And so we're going to post that. So that's the story. So we're going to have on Leon Gast on this episode of the podcast, talking about his memories about Muhammad Ali, the subject of his film When We Were Kings, as well as his friend. And I think we caught him when he was feeling a little bit thrown. I think he was receiving a lot of calls and people reaching out to him, like myself. So I really do appreciate that he gave us all the time he did. And we're going to listen to that conversation right now. My conversation with Leon Gast about Muhammad Ali.
I've done something new for this fight. I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick. Too fast! Too fast!
The king is going home to get his throne.
Yeah, when I get to Africa, we gonna get it on because we don't get alone.
So we try to get the champions of the sports world, champions of the music world.
You know, it was handsome, it was articulate, it was funny, it was whooping ass, too.
With the George Foreman was a phenomenon.
The big bad monster, and no one can whoop him.
We're gonna fly in the air till we get to Zaire.
This chump has got everybody scared.
They thought he would take one of the world's worst beatings ever, and he wouldn't give up.
Scared of what?
In a time of courage in the jungles of Zaire.
I like to tell the children of the world, quit eating so much candy. We must whip Mr. Tooth Decay. I got one right here, one right here.
A man named Mohammed created his own destiny.
That means kill him.
This is his moment of truth.
Kids today will be missing a whole lot if they don't know about the legacy of Muhammad Ali, because no matter what era you live in, you see very few true heroes.
Hang you out, sucker.
Hello.
Leon?
Yes.
Hey, it's Adam Shartoff. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good.
I'm going down to Louisville. I'm waiting to hear back from Lonnie. She was putting me on a list. Giving me further information.
Would this be for the funeral then?
Yes. I was down there about 8 months ago with my wife. We spent a couple of days in Louisville, and they had a private screening of Kings, and Ali was not able to attend, and as you probably know, he has no movement, and he can't speak. And I was actually relieved to hear
that he's at the very best discomfort, at the worst suffering, physically suffering, and
yes.
And also it seemed as though his mind was in relatively good shape for I don't know how long, but you know, that's got to be torture.
Oh yes, absolutely. And my wife and I went down there in I guess it was July last year. Spent a couple of days down there. They had a little private screening, and
I see.
Ali was not able to attend, but we had spent time with him during the day and that night, and took a bunch of pictures and Lonnie, his wife, said, "You'll have to speak directly into his ear." And I could see that his expression changed from time to time. And I asked him, "You remember when we got off the plane and we heard those people saying, Ali Bumbai, hey, what does that mean? What does that mean? That mean
this
Ali
is,
killed him."
This was
Zaire? He didn't stop for a couple hours.
This was in Zaire?
Hollering, Ali Bumbai, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept on calling it the Congo.
The Congo.
And everybody corrected him. It's not the Congo, it's Zaire. He had the same response. Have no fear, everybody know it's Zaire. And it was a great time just having the privilege to be around him. And we're going down to the funeral. There's going to be a private one on one of those 2 days and then a public one on another day, but I'm still waiting to hear from her.
I understand. Leon, before you mentioned when Muhammad Ali got off the plane and how all the people in Zaire, you know, were waiting for him at the airport, that was very typical all over the world. I was thinking, I was watching, you know, of course, there's so much coverage, but who else could land in any airport anywhere on the entire globe, and no matter where he got off, there were just people in every country. Couldn't wait to just to lay eye on
every country in the world. And back in 1974, everybody said he's the most popular man in the world. You can go anywhere in the world and you can ask, "Do you know who Muhammad Ali is?" And everybody knew who he was. And he was the most generous person. And just the most generous person. Not only with his time, but also with his money. Bob Arum once said to me, when I first met Bob, you can give Muhammad $50,000 on 49th Street, and by the time he gets to 48th Street, he won't have a penny left.
That's great.
And he was a wonderful human being. And he was just friendly, bright, could, do commentary about everything, and he could do, he was analytic also. I mean, he was a lot brighter than a lot of people realize. And he was just...
Well, he was very, very funny and sharp, and I think that that's usually an indication of someone who's exceptionally bright, you know. But it was clear. You could just see it in his eyes. He was a step ahead of most people. You know what's also another thing that I was thinking about in the last day or two? When I heard that Ali had died, I felt like a part of my own identity somehow is a little less than what it was the day before. Like, as a kid, all my life, there was always Muhammad Ali. You know, he's part of my narrative. And I'm just mentioning myself because I think I represent a lot of people. And now that he's gone, it feels like a piece of ourselves is gone as well.
Yes. And certainly in my life. And boy.
I know you said you're probably going down for the funeral, and that you've also let me know you've been close to him all these years, so I didn't know that. But do you remember back in 1997, your big night, you won the Oscar for Best Documentary?
Yeah.
You went up to...
Yes. Everybody should experience a night like that.
I went to YouTube because I didn't remember that George Foreman and Muhammad Ali came up to the stage as well. That was incredible.
And I was told by some of the Academy big shots that's the first time at an Oscar presentation that two people came up out of the audience and came up onto the stage. And we spent the night with them. And it was just incredible. I did see him 8-9 months ago down in Louisville, and I could see by the look in his eyes that he was understanding everything that we were saying. And Jerry, my wife, was taking photographs and took maybe 20 or 30 and 40 maybe, and his lawyer contacted me yesterday and sent me another dozen pictures from the same setting, different angle. And it was just a different angle than the ones I had been looking at for the last 10, 15, 20 years. And it brought back a lot of memories. And you know, somebody would say, I don't know if you heard about the time when, and I'd say, no, I don't think I've heard that one. Well, let me tell you this story. And then I'd meet somebody else that had a personal experience. And I'd hear another story, and then another story. And they all had to do with his kindness, accessibility. I never saw him, of course, later on when he couldn't write, but during the period when I first met him and we were at various dinners, he never would turn down an autograph. If somebody came by and asked him for an autograph, they got it. And he remembered, and he had told me a story about when the Olympics, and he was in New York City, and he went up to, he wanted to know where Sugar Ray Robinson was, because that was his idol. And they said, well, Sugar Ray has a barbershop, a cleaning store, and up on St. Nicholas Avenue up in Harlem between 127, 128, whatever. Ali walked up there
You really?
And waited. until Sugar Ray Robinson. He wasn't there, but he came and he had, I think, a pink Cadillac convertible. And when Sugar Ray got out of the car and walked to go into one of his establishments, and Cassius Clay, he said, my name is Cassius Clay. I'm going to the Olympics. And Sugar Ray said, I'm busy, kid. Get out of my way. And at that point, Clay made a promise to himself. I will never turn away anybody asking me for an autograph or a question. And
or just his attention. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Amazing. So, amazing man.
And I first met him in August of 1974, a month before he was leaving for Zaire. And George Foreman got cut, and the fight was delayed.
Right.
And Mobutu wouldn't let either of the fighters leave the country because he was frightened. And the music, the concert had to go ahead because all of those groups, James Brown, B.B. King, Bill Withers, all of them had
Miriam Makeba.
Mm-hmm. And there was no way that they could cancel the music festival.
Right. Right.
So the music festival went on, and there were hardly any seats at all sold to the music festival. And most of the press left because the fight was put off for another 5 weeks, I think it was. So,
wow.
And Ali was there, and, oh, gosh, that's what really gave me the opportunity to spend lots of time with him.
What a
lots
gift.
Of time.
It was a real gift, huh?
And then, what?
It sounds like a real gift.
Oh, gosh. One of the greatest gifts I ever got. And then at one point he said, outside when we first left from one of the New York airports, I'm not sure, I think it was LaGuardia, and flying to Boston, then going to Spain, I believe, and then to Africa, and then changing again in somewhere in Northwest Africa. But at one point he said, just don't get in my face. And, you know, I thought, oh, my God, he doesn't like me. And then we got to Africa, and he said, you want to get a good shot? When I run. I go out at 5 o'clock in the morning. You come up to Incelli where I am. I'll show you where you should set up your cameras and blah 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 blah. And he was directing the film.
Yeah.
You know, he was telling the angles and anyway, one of the luckiest men in the world.
Thank you so much for sharing those memories. Really, it's very touching, and I really appreciate it in light of that you're just kind of lost a friend.
You're welcome.
Take care, Leon Gast, Oscar-winning documentary filmmaker. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. For you, the listeners of FilmWax Radio, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Now, I take a lot of car rides myself, long car rides on the weekends or to work, and I have become very, very addicted to Audible myself. Two titles, for instance, that I recently downloaded was Roger Corman, a prior guest of the show, what's called Roger Corman, Blood-Sucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers by Beverly Gray. And also a former guest, William Friedkin. He has his memoir called The Friedkin Connection, two great titles. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/filmwaxradio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/filmwaxradio for your free audiobook. Okay, there's another documentary called The Trials of Muhammad Ali. And that one is actually going to have a second run at Film Forum this Friday, June 10th. So if you're in the New York area and you want to check that, it's another great documentary, which is, I think, produced in part by Cartemquin Films out of Chicago. Anyway, Bill Siegel is the director of that podcast, and he said he would do the segment with me when he gets back from the Ali funeral. So we'll see about that, but it's another great film, so it would be great to bring Bill on the show. Right now, though, we're going to go into my conversation with the filmmaker Beth B. She was part of the downtown art scene in New York in the 70s and 80s, and when New York was a very different city, and she's going to talk about that with me in great detail, as well as her new documentary, which is in part about her mom and her mother's artistic endeavors, but it's also about her relationship with her mom, and it's called Call Her Applebrug, and it's going to be again at the Metrograph Theater as of Friday, June the 10th. So here's my conversation with Beth B.
I was born in the Bronx, New York. I was a child of immigrant parents. I learned very early on, from living in this rigid household, how power works.
I'll stone them. I'll kick down their walls. I'll burn down their supermarkets. I'll ban churches. I'll make cripples walk again.
Why did you choose that woman coming down the stairs? Why? Do you know why? You like the shape?
Because she was there?
Yes. Okay.
I'd say it's about our collective anxieties. I'm more interested in doing something to the viewer than saying something to the viewer. Okay. May I please end on that? I need to go.
Lots.
Leave me alone. You're a pain in the ass.
I love you too.
I disagree. Do you know, I was just, for 2 years in a row, I went to the Montclair Film Festival, which is pretty close.
It is.
Hold up the mic. Hold it close to your ears. You're soft spoken.
My daughter goes to school in Montclair.
Oh, very good.
Yes. I love it there.
Well, they have a wonderful film festival, you know.
Yes, I know. I've
okay.
shown in it.
Oh,
my
yeah.
film exposed show.
Oh, right. You're I guess, friendly with Tom Powers, of course, because
yes.
he programmed also
yeah.
that into Doc NYC, which is where I saw it.
Yeah.
I think it was the year I was working with Doc of NYC.
Oh,
I put together, I was working on the panels that year.
Gotcha. Well,
should I call you Beth? What else
Beth,
am I call
that's
you?
Who I am.
That's
Beth B.
Okay, call me Adam then. Yeah, so I'm glad we met because it's also, you know, as I've been doing this, I've just managed to talk to a lot of people who, you know, have been around in the during that seminal period of time in the 70s and later, where a lot of different art was coming out of New York City. It just seemed to be more of a, obviously, a looser time in the sense that you didn't have to define yourself as a filmmaker. That's it. That's what you did. Or it would be confusing to people if you said, well, I'm a multimedia artist, experimental artist, what have you. You know, people just want to... But back then it seemed like everybody was freer.
Well, I think that in some ways people who came to New York at that time kind of broke the specialization apart, exploded that concept. And that was, you know, fantastic. It was like let chaos reign. So... You know, I started out as an artist, but in the late 70s in New York City, it was a time when everybody was starting to experiment with different mediums and different modes of expression, and so in a way it was very anti-specialization and crossing over into different mediums. And, you know, it really was, mm-hmm. I think, in some ways the invention of DIY.
Mm-hmm.
And saying, I can do whatever I want to do. And for me, that really was an influential attitude in that I felt like, for me, the idea was the most important thing. And then figuring out what medium would best express
right.
that idea. So I don't consider myself a filmmaker or an artist or a sculptress, or I consider myself a creator.
Right. And that you can feel constrained, obviously, if you're trying to do something creatively and then you're only supposed to sculpt it. You know?
Yeah, and for me, you know, it was all about going against constraint.
Mm-hmm.
It was finding a kind of freedom of expression and not having anyone tell me what I could and could not do. And it was also a time very sort of anti-censorship and really saying things that people really didn't want to hear. And I think that's been the thread through most of my work, is really giving voice to the unheard.
What's your memory of the sense of community downtown?
Well, it was... There was community downtown. You know?
First of all, there was a downtown.
It was Soho and Tribeca and Lower East Side. And, you know, it was vacant. It was all these abandoned warehouses.
Right.
And,
or blocks that just were... You could walk for blocks, and there wasn't one operating a residential building.
It was all, you know, manufacturing. Those were the buildings, the lofts at that time. And so a lot of artists went in and just took hold of these extraordinary spaces, these lofts, and created living situations. A lot of them were totally illegal. And made them into workspaces or film studios or, you know, whatever your needs be. But there was a sense of community that I think was very unique at that time, where, you know, you walked out on the streets and you would just run into people, sort of, you know, whether they were filmmakers, actors, performers, artists, and you'd go from, you know, sometimes on a Friday night from party to party, people left their doors open, you'd hear music coming from above, and you'd go up and someone was doing a performance, because no one lived in that area except the outsiders. We were the outsiders. And we came and claimed that area in a very different way than it looks right now.
Sounds like the claim staker, you know,
the
pioneers. That
the artists always lead.
Yeah, sure. Until Wall Street catches up to
them. Exactly. The realtors suddenly go, oh my God, we have a gold mine here.
Yeah.
So now the landscape has changed dramatically. But at that time, the landscape was really, it was like demolished buildings and junkies on the streets and hordes of, you know.
Could you romanticize it? I mean, it's just not.
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah.
I felt
you did
like
in the moment back then, in hindsight.
And I wish it was still like that now. I mean, you think about Times Square God, what that was like. Because to me, you know, I had been coming from Southern California. I grew up actually in Chicago, and then at age 13 moved to San Diego with my family. And when we moved there, I felt like I had died. You know, it was so conservative, Navy Town, sun, you know, burning my skin.
Fair, I can attest to.
It was mind-numbing. And so when I finally, you know, at 18, moved to New York, as soon as I got here, I was like, looked at the filth on the streets and the people, and I said, I'm home. These are my people. And it really is this attraction to the underdog. And that's also been a thread in most of my work.
Well, it also comes around, we can touch on your new documentary. It's called Call Her Applebrug. And it's about your mom. And, of course, I have questions about why now, but we'll come to that, too. But I have actually, first, your mom, of course, grew up in the Bronx.
Right.
She was a child of survivors, right? Was she not?
No,
or
they
she
were not.
They came before?
They came
saw
before.
The writing
parents,
on the wall?
Her parents came just before the war.
Okay. So they saw the writing on the wall. Thank God. They
were even pre.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But Orthodox Jews.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, there's some incredible. You have some footage of your grandmother in there in your film, which was remarkable because she sounds like, you know, just like the old lady. She's mein God, like, you know. She was so sweet, but it was an oppressive. I know, also very impressive for your mom.
Very male dominated, oppressive kind of family and atmosphere to grow up in, where females are not valued at all. And there were three children. And they were all girls in my mother's family.
Are either of her sisters around? I keep using
one
the word surviving.
Is.
Okay.
One is, yes.
Your mother, while we're on the subject, she's just so I mean, I know now she's physically getting on, it seems as though, but just seems incredibly youthful. I mean, she really just amazing, even though she is a tough, what do we call her, like a tough character, tough. I mean, she is, she doesn't suffer fools, it seems.
No, she does not. But she is, I think her work has always felt very, in my mind, very timeless and very young. And often when people see her work, they think it's been done by a young artist. And I think, partially, I think it is that she started her career quite in her later years, when she was 45, is when she really started.
Yeah, I did the math, and I was remembering her. She was mentioning her first shows, and it sounded like she was talking about the 70s a lot. And I just, well, that was 40
she
years
and
ago.
I, yes.
40-some years ago, and I'm saying, but she was already in her 40s. Interesting.
Well, she and I, interestingly enough, started our careers about the same time in New York City because, you know, it's a very different generation, her generation. She grew up really with the sort of the Mad Men values where you go out of the house, you get married, you have a family, the female stays in the house and takes care of the husband and the children. And so she really did come out of that background, and it took her quite a while. Even though she was doing her art all the while, it was in the basement. It was on the, you know, next to the washer and dryer, and it was in her spare time. And so she had to really come to a pretty dramatic reckoning, which she did in her mid-40s, to really say, I am dedicating my life to my career. And she, at that point in time, moved out of our home, and we were on our own for a little while. But, you know, it was interesting because somehow even at age 13 when that happened, even though it was devastating to me as a 13-year-old, and my mother did eventually come back to the family, I somehow really, really understood what she was grappling with, and I totally supported her. And in some ways, I think I was a 13-year-old feminist. I really wanted my mother to have her life.
She discusses openly in the film she had dealt with a certain amount of mental.
It was depression,
depression,
severe depression, and
depression.
Suicide. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Was that before she left, or was that something that she just sort of felt like she had to take away from her and hide from her children?
No, that was going on in our household, and you know, sort of very painful memories of being by her bedside where she really could not respond and could not be in the world. And then it became so severe that she was hospitalized.
Yeah.
And so it was a period of time where it kind of grew and became more amplified, the depression. And then she did go into a hospital for some time. And then when she came out, she then moved and ended up getting a separate place and a studio so that she could really pursue her career. And, you know, thank God.
Right.
Thank
well,
God.
Well, she may and not really have lived.
Was, pardon me?
She may not have lived through,
yes,
you know,
I mean,
otherwise.
And I think that for her generation, there were a lot of women who did not survive, who chose suicide because it was sort of a time when women were grappling. Is this all there is to life?
Yeah, it's pretty bleak.
Well, and a lot of women always still deal with it today, but I think that there is a change, and that's what's so fascinating for me is that, you know, I think I struggled for many years with my career is the most important thing, and I will not let anything get in the way. Okay, that was my feminist slant on life. And it took me, you know, till I was in my mid-40s to finally, you know, after a lot of therapy and, you know, dealing with my past and history, to say, you know, I actually do want a family and a child, and, you know, thank God I was able to do that, and I have that today. I have, like, a wonderfully rich life where I do have my work, but I also have my family, and I have, you know, wonderful husband and daughter. My daughter's only 13, so I'm an older person and a wiser person. And what a phenomenal thing to know, I think, for women that, you know what, you can have a career and you can have a family, but it's very difficult. It's extremely stressful, and sometimes I do feel a little caught between my priorities.
Do you feel like it's still a man's, I mean, essentially a man's world?
Oh, of course. You know that, okay. And I know that.
All right.
Just look at the statistics, honey. It's like how many female directors are there in Hollywood? Let's not even be honest.
Exactly. A few percent.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think it's not just in Hollywood. It's in every field, and we know that. But, you know, that never stopped me. I never even felt like I would be hindered by my gender because I was so driven. I was just driven and felt like nothing can stop me. And I still feel that today, but I'm a little mellower.
Things are a little less urgent around all these things. Now it's like breathe, spend some time with the kids.
It's perspective.
Life is what
it's perspective
is.
It's perspective also. Right?
But that initial fervor, that ambition, whatever you want to call it, did that come from, you said you sort of had inklings of that even at 13, what seems amazing by supporting your mom's decision to leave the house, but for a period of time. Is this some of that rub off from your mom, or where does that come from, this strain in your character?
I think for me it has to do with idealism. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Isn't that, to me, that's sort of, I really go back to that, you know, and I think that the late 70s, early 80s, everyone was very idealistic. What we're going to do and how we're going to change the world. And it was really these big ideas and the idea of content. We have got to, you know, pull the wool off the eyes. You know, we've got to show the realities, show the facts, show what people are not willing to look at. And you know what? It has driven me my whole life. And even though, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh, shit, I can't change the world. But you know what? I'm still as idealistic. And I feel like if there's even one person in the audience that I can kind of open something up in their own mind, then that's what I want. That to me is success. Just to have a small piece of revelation in one audience member is that's my idealism.
It seems to be running through our conversation too, like just getting closer to your authentic self. Your mother went through that. She had to kind of reject everything, even the hardest thing, which is her own kids and her own family. One could look at it like rejection in a way.
No, it was survival.
It was absolutely survival. But she had to she had to kind of reject all the surface things conventions in order to get to the inner core of herself and figure out what that identity was, so she wouldn't have that bleak outlook, which is this or all there is, which you said.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of it also I don't think is conscious. I mean, just the way sort of in making the film, Call Her Applebrug, I was always struck by how difficult it was to get my mother to reveal anything.
Yeah.
You know, she really does come from a very private place. She does not like to share anything or have a camera on her at all. And it took me 15 years of filming a little bit here, a little bit there to make the film. And all the while with great resistance. You know, finally when it was sort of maybe, I guess, 2 years ago, I still felt like I had not gotten what I really needed to get. And that was the really hardcore emotional backbone of the film. And she kept saying, you filmed me so many times already. Why do you have to film me again? Why do you have to film me again? I kept saying, because I don't have the film that I need. I don't have that emotional bridge to lend and to open people's eyes to the connection between your emotional life and your work. And it was then, you know, only 2 years ago that she started to open up a little bit more about her history and some of the more personal aspects of her life that, I feel, in a way, you know, are embedded in all of the series of pieces that she's done. Somewhere in there is that, you know, that core of sort of very profound struggle that she had to go through in her 40s to be able to be where she is today and to really, you know, be the artist that she wanted to be her whole life. So finally, after filming all those years, you know, she opened up, and, you know, that's where the green dress, there are three sequences of the green dress, which were harking back to the time when she was in the hospital having a breakdown. So, you know, suffering from depression. So in a way, that sort of weaves through the film, and in some way, I think, echoes through the work that she's done as an artist.
She took just a pile of sketchbooks with her when she was going to the hospital. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and also you mentioned it took years of filming her to get her to kind of crack open and start to share, be, let's call it, vulnerable.
Yes.
Well, it's clear your mom requires time. It took her 20 years before she could grieve for her sister.
Right.
She lost one of her sisters. Mm-hmm. And she talks about that, which was a very revealing, but it was a very powerful moment. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's an example of what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then there's another moment, which was, in one sense, an example of how reserved and cautious and, your mom can be. But on another level, it was incredibly open. It was also expressive at the same exact time. She says at one moment in the film, and I don't think I'm giving away anything reveal wise, but she says, it's like you can talk. You remind me of the exact words where she can. You feel like she can share everything now with you, or you.
Oh, right.
And she said, "No, I can do it now.
I can do
right
it now.
Right.
Not always. Right.
So, but just even opening up and admitting that shows that she was really able to kind of in her own way explain what she's able to do.
Yeah. Well, I think that just by the nature of making a documentary film, so much depends on your relationship with the subject and trust. And you would think, okay, well, we're mother and daughter, of course there's trust. But when you put a camera in between, it changes the dynamic completely.
Absolutely.
And there are some people who say, oh, well, you know, after a couple of days with the camera, you're totally comfortable and it's, you know, nothing. But in some ways, some people don't get comfortable with the camera. And she was someone who did not get comfortable with the camera until maybe the last year, maybe. But I think that as a documentarian, it's, in a way, it's my job to try to create an atmosphere of trust so that we can get beyond the surface and start kind of peeling the layers and look at what, in a sense, drives a person and who they really are beyond the surface that we are seeing, beyond, and Exposed. My film Exposed is very much about that also. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, here is the presentation of the self, but what are we seeing underlying that and what is motivating that? And, you know, it's often we all have our histories that, you know, I am really a true believer that, you know, how we were brought up so much forms who we are today. And yet we do, I think, in some ways we are powerless, but in other ways I think that we can change the dynamics and the behavior that we have in our lives. But it takes a lot of work. And so in some ways I think a lot of my films are about revealing the kind of pain that we as human beings, I think, universally go through. I mean, childhood is tough. I don't know, you know, no matter what kind of family you have, I think there are dynamics there that as a child you just can't really understand and struggle with. And I think that, you know, by going back and understanding some of that, you can then make decisions about how you behave and react or respond in life, as opposed to carrying on generations of behavior. And so that also, I guess, is sort of like, you know, one of my films was about, you know, was about Vietnam veterans, and I brought three Vietnam veterans and their adult children back to Vietnam to look at intergenerational trauma from war. And that, you know, it just fascinates me. Like, what, and, and in that journey with these families, you know, the children who are now adults, but they, you know, they really talked, suddenly started to open up about the damage that had been caused by their fathers unknowingly. Unknowingly, it's not ever intentional. But because of their damage, they, the children take on those issues and behaviors, and that it's through a process of revealing and really ruthlessly and bravely tackling our pasts and our histories that maybe we can become sort of lighter, more human beings, if that makes sense to you.
It does. As you're talking, and I was kind of relating to what you're saying about a specific thing that I'm dealing with myself, and I think you're exactly the same idea there.
Well, it's like
that
where do you stop? Where, you know, the cycle. I mean, it's always the history was the cycle of violence. But it's not just the cycle of violence. Cycle of violence, abuse, behavior, alcoholism, drugs,
right,
all
right,
of it.
Right.
You know, okay, where, you know, what is my responsibility? And that's what I always ask myself just in general. And I think that's what my films are asking people. Okay, what is our responsibility? Because we all have a responsibility, but we don't want to think that we do, you know. And what dance are we playing with that other person or that family dynamic and the drama that ensues? So, in, you know, I for me, it's, you know, even Two Small Bodies is very much about that. And that will be shown at the Metrograph Theater on June. Well, we don't have the date yet, but somewhere between June 10th and June 16th, a lot of my other films, my older films, will be shown during that week.
Sort of a retrospective.
It is a retrospective. I mean, not all my films. I've made about 30 films.
We're talking with Beth B., who has a new documentary about her mother, Ida Applebrook. Call her Applebrook. And it's going to be having a theatrical engagement at the Metrograph in downtown New York City beginning June
10th.
Friday, June 10th.
There will be three shows that night. Friday night, June 10th is when it opens. It runs till the 16th. But also that week there will be a number of my other films.
So you'll basically set up a pup tent in their courtyard.
No.
You're going to be there
Ida and I will be there for June 10th, the 8 o'clock and the 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock shows for Q&A. And I think, and I'll be there. You know,
sure.
I'm sure I'm going to be there Saturday night, and I'll be there some of the other screenings as well. It'll be announced on the Metrograph website.
Well, at one point earlier in our conversation, you referenced being around the same age as your mom when you started professionally, but that's not right, is it? Didn't you start in your...
I started in my 20s, and she was in her 40s.
So I see. You were saying around the same period of time.
Yeah, so mid-70s.
I see. Very good.
We both came to New York City, and we both started our...
You both came from... Where were you said you were?
From San Diego. Yeah.
Where you were being raised in your in this triptych around the country, because you lived, as you said, in Chicago and then San Diego and then New York. And your mom returned to New York also at the same time, around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, hang out?
Yeah, you know, I actually lived in her loft. I was going to school at the School of Visual Arts my last year.
Where you now are, I've come full circle. And
yes, I teach there. Yeah,
I'm faculty here.
I teach at SVA in the art department. And so I lived with her for a little while in Soho, and then I got my own place in Tribeca, a loft there. But we pretty close. I mean, that's sort of, you know, we've stayed very close. We're, colleagues, best friends, and she's my mother.
Right. What was the story with your father? Is he still around?
No, he died last year.
Only last year.
Yeah, it was an interesting time because he was in the hospital for 2 months, and I, you know, really wasn't sure what I was going to do with all this footage that I had shot about my mother, about Ida. And during those 2 months, I would visit him during the day, and I would go home, and it was like my sanity was to go home and edit like an insane person till like 2-3 in the morning, and then go to sleep, get up, go to see him in the hospital the next day, and then come home and edit again. And then by the time he died, I said to Ida, I think I finished the film. The editing process was very intuitive. The film is non-linear and in moments experimental, and yet it tells a very comprehensive and very deep story. It's very personal and emotional. So it's an unconventional biographical piece, but it kind of came together in an unexpected way. And I think it was sort of that combination of pain and pleasure. So the pain of my father dying and the pleasure of creation.
Sure. That makes sense. And have you always edited as well all your films? I know you were edited or co-edited, exposed.
Now, when I was first making films, I loved to edit Super 8. I loved it, this tiny little gauge, you know, putting the tapes, so it was very tactile. But then I went into, after a number of years of working in film, you know, I did a couple of 35-millimeter feature narrative films, Two Small Bodies and Salvation. And then it was a really very difficult time for independent filmmakers. There was no funding anymore. The Europeans stopped funding because that's where I had been getting some funding.
Is this like in the late 90s? Or?
It was in the mid-90s. Mid-90s and late 90s. And I then went and did a very low-budget documentary about juvenile sex offenders, and a friend of mine saw it, and she was working as a development executive at Court TV. Her name was Lynn Kirby, and she said, you know, you should be doing some work here. And I then entered into 8 years of producing and directing and executive producing hour-long documentaries at Court TV, which was fabulous. I brought them my stories, and they said, yeah, go do it. So, you know,
It's almost like being a reporter for some sort of newspaper.
And it really, you know, I really got my chops doing that. And so during that period of time, I had the luxury to hire people to edit the films. But when I came out of that, I really kind of, at a certain point, I was like, I've got to get back to the passion of my creativity, which is, you know, making my films the way I totally uncensored, because of course with television, even though they were wonderful, and you know, I also worked a little at Sundance Channel and TLC, a number of networks, you know, it's like narration, cut this, cut that, rewrite that, you know, I'm an employee and it's corporate. And so I finally felt like after about 8 years, I've got to get back to my work, and that's really where Exposed came. And I was like, I went back to my roots. I went to the clubs. I found these extraordinary performers. And it was this wonderful feeling that, oh, I can get back to, in a way, a life.
But the whole independent film world had changed, right? And now, I mean, the film was embraced by the, especially documentary film festivals, right?
Yeah.
But,
extraordinary.
While we're on the subject, where was the festival premiere of
Exposed?
Of Call Her Applebrug.
It premiered at the Museum of Modern Art.
Oh, right, at Doc Fortnite.
Doc Fortnite.
That's right. Yes, I remember. I heard very good things about this season, actually.
The screening.
And Sally Berger has been on this podcast.
Sally is phenomenal. Sally Berger, and you know, I felt like it was like the height of my career. It was sold out, and it felt like the whole art world and film world came. It was emotional. I was like, oh my God, it really was, Ida was there, so we did a wonderful Q&A.
Wow.
But I feel like, you know, in some ways my life is kind of coming full circle, and in a way, I don't know, maybe it's with age, maybe it's with that I'm a little more humble and open with who I am, that I feel like, and vulnerable, feeling like my films are becoming more and more personal and
definitely
revealing of who
I didn't expect
I
that the film I saw for all the in all the best ways. I mean, you know, I really I was like, wow, this is it's not sentimental, but it's
not
highly personal and moving. So
yeah,
there's this difference.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I felt like it was the most difficult film I've ever made. Very complex and, you know, scary. It was a scary film to make because, you know, on the one hand, I want to make the strongest and best film that I can. On the other hand, of course, I want to please my mother and make sure I don't offend her in any way. But I really was very careful to say to her, you know, I have to make the film that I need to make.
She wrote probably respected that just as a professional, right? I mean,
well, except, you know, she was like, yes, but I, you know, at a certain point she got like, but I want to make sure I see it and there's nothing in there that I don't want. And I was like, well, you can see it, but I can't really promise you that. So do you understand, as a professional, I'm working on one level. As a daughter, I'm working on another level. And so in
some ways... Right, and then realistically, you can't separate those things completely. You can try, but I mean, come on, they're intertwined on some level.
So, you know, I think as a filmmaker, you always want to be sensitive to your subject, but this was really amplified. And
sure.
I had to make sure that primarily I made the strongest film that I could make, but it was definitely fraught with... lot of confusing moments, let's say that, in the editing room.
What did Ida make of it? What did she think?
Oh, she loved it. The first two times she saw it, she said to me, I don't remember a single thing I saw.
Yeah, that
because
seems
she
to be
was
a
overwhelmed by seeing, you know, she's a very shy person, a very private person, and then suddenly there's a film where, you know, for 70 minutes, it's her, she's there, she's
and
it.
She's bigger than ever.
And she's bigger than God. And so she was, I think, very nervous and frightened. But, you know, I think the screening at MoMA, she said, I felt like I saw it for the first time.
Right.
I really saw it. And she said, and it's brilliant. You're brilliant. So, you know, I really feel like she is totally embracing it and has been traveling with me, you know, showing it and
fantastic.
Loves it. Yeah.
That's great. So, well, once more, it's going to be, if you're in New York, you'll be able to not only see, call her Applebrook, but you can even meet Ida Applebrook if you come down to the Metrograph. It's beginning June 10th. Well, she'll be there certainly June 10th.
June 10th.
Yeah.
I will be there, and Ida will be there, and for the 6 o'clock and the 8 o'clock shows, we will do a Q&A.
Very good.
So please come. We would love to invite you into this very intimate and dramatic film.
And it's a great theater, which...
Oh, it's beautiful. The Metrograph is just gorgeous.
I saw a movie made on film. New one.
Yes, they're
made
showing...
on film and projected... on film.
They're showing my 35mm prints.
Yeah.
I'm so thrilled.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
It is.
And what's wonderful is it's in the neighborhood. You know, it's Ludlow Street.
Right.
It's at the corner of Canal.
Right. And if you squint just so, you can almost convince yourself you're back in 1983. And thank you very much.
Thank you
so really
much,
Adam. It
was
really a pleasure
Adam.
To meet you. Last up, folks, here we have the wonderful Bill Plimpton, a friend of the podcast. Bill was on just about maybe a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, with his last animated feature. It's called Cheatin', and he is now back with this mockumentary about, it's pretty, you know, it's not for those who are easily offended. That's the way we're phrasing it. What if Hitler had been accepted into art school and pursued a career in art? And this kind of explores that in a very satirical way in the great format of mockumentary. So I urge you to go to his site. It's Plimptoons, PLYPMTOONS.com. It's currently there for streaming in full. And you should do that. And you should listen to this conversation first so you have some background, some context for that. And then we'll be back right after this conversation with Bill just to kind of wind things down. We'll be right back. So, Bill Plimpton, back on the podcast. I think I talked to you at the last, your last feature.
Cheating
indeed. And now you're back. It's called Hitler's Folly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mockumentary.
Yes.
Have you made a non-animation feature before?
Oh, yeah. I've done three of them, actually. I did Jay Lyle, which was a big flop, huge flop.
Well, if you're going to make a flop, make it huge.
Make it big.
Go out
swinging. Then I did Guns on the Clackamas, which is also a mockumentary, actually, a Western mockumentary. And that was somewhat successful. And then I did a documentary about Walt Curtis, who's a poet friend of mine, who's a real interesting guy. Those are the three films I've done before this with without animation.
Oh,
although
good.
This has animation. This has about a third
right.
animated.
That's true. I mean, it's all the sort of the premise is what if if our man Hitler, the Führer, had decided or had not. Who had been accepted into art school, right? Because
yeah.
he was rejected,
yeah,
right? He was
rejected,
and so
yeah.
the premise could, the subtext being that maybe this contributed to his state of mind.
Yeah.
You know, maybe he would have become as an artist, gone a different path to some degree.
And some cartoonists can be very cruel anyway, you know, especially political cartoonists can be very cruel. So mm-hmm. maybe that he would have been a political cartoonist.
Name names.
Oh, Conrad.
You are going to name names. That's great.
Yeah. Bill Plimpton.
I was going to ask you where you fell on the scale.
I used to do political cartoons.
Mm-hmm. So what's wrong with you?
What do you mean?
This is a pretty wild premise. It's a pretty wild mm-hmm. idea to do.
Yeah.
But you came up with this idea a couple of years ago?
Yeah, I was watching, I read a magazine, and I read that Hitler was a big fan of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Oh, right.
And just the whole concept of the most evil man in history loving the antics of the funny little dwarfs and laughing his head off just is too surreal for me. And then, as you said, I thought of the whole concept of him being rejected by the Film Academy or the Art Academy, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And what if he'd gotten in? You know, what would the world have been like if he had actually been accepted by the Art Academy? And that got me to thinking about the alternative reality, alternative universe.
What you say, the most evil man in history. I understand that actually, Attila the Hun
was
fond of a bunch of there were a bunch of sketch drawings in the
See,
and
there
the
you
cave
go.
Cave sketch drawings.
I should
cave.
Do a sequel, right?
Maybe so. You might have the cornered on the particular genre.
Yeah.
So the film has it's a combination. There's the mockumentary aspect of it is also it's told through this guy who's on what is he on? Is he
he's
shooting himself?
Josh. Yeah.
Right.
And he's very paranoid because his best friend, who's a conspiracy nut, got killed by who knows what kind of forces, evil forces out there. So he wants to bring to light this, to expose this alternative history that Hitler really was a cartoonist and that he really wasn't the one who brought all this death and destruction to World War II. It was actually his wife, Eva Braun, who was the mastermind of all these evil wars and evil battles.
Mm-hmm. How much time did you have to spend figuring out all those particulars so that way you could make this alternate
There was actually
reality.
A lot of writing. I wrote a lot of script, and I think it's over 100 pages long. And I showed a rough cut of the film to people, and they said it was too long. So I cut out some really fun bits, and that to me that was hard because I thought they were so funny. But what we will do if we bring out a DVD is put in those other bits that are really wacky. Like I think I mentioned the Italian, you know, Mussolini wanted to get involved in filmmaking, and he had big plans to make his own epic animated film and things like that.
Right. Well, it's like you're a kid in a candy shop. I mean, all of a sudden, you know, all that you're saying, oh, there's so much of it to do.
There's so much material here. Yeah.
It's endless.
I did a film earlier, a short film, about 10 years earlier, and it was called Santa the Fascist Years.
Right.
And this one I took jolly old Saint Nick and turned him into a raving fascist who wants to take over the world. So I sort of flipped it on this one. I took Hitler, who was an evil guy, and made him a jolly old happy guy cartoonist. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of humor when you do that, when you take someone's personality and totally flip it to the other side. That's where a lot of humor comes from. So the Santa the Fascist Years was a big hit. Mm-hmm. So I knew that there was some humor there that people would enjoy. Mm-hmm. However, I didn't know that I didn't know if some people might be easily offended by this, and I expect some will. But I think that you have to have a sense of humor. You need a sense of humor to survive this world today with all the tensions and the terrorists and Trump and the big three T's.
Right.
And so you need humor to survive. And if you take everything too seriously, it's going to be a terrible life for you.
Yeah. Well, I did think the timing of Hitler's Folly, which is going to be streaming free on the Plimptunes website.
Thank
starting,
you so much.
Sure. Starting
the 3rd of June.
The 3rd of June, which is
soon.
Just hours away.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, no, it's this. Is that Friday or something?
I think it's Friday.
Friday the 3rd.
Right,
well, it's just June 3rd. We can even.
Yeah, June 3rd.
June 3rd.
It's plimptunes.com.
Thank you. You can go there and watch it for nothing.
Yes, yes.
Except for good, for belly laughs.
Can I tell you why I do that? Why I'm doing that?
I was going to make a point of getting to that.
Okay.
As a choice.
I'll beat you to the punch.
We buried the lead in a way. We should have started with it.
The film has a lot of old archival footage and photographs and interviews and things like that that I don't really have the rights to. I mean, a lot of it is off the internet or old World War II footage, which I know is pretty much public domain, but you're never sure. Mm-hmm. So I don't have the money to go to a copyright lawyer and have someone search through every drawing and every bit of sound and music and for me to pay all the legal issues to do all that. So I just thought it'd be easier to let it go for free, let people see it for free. If they like the film and they want to donate to pay for my next film, then that would be delightful. But it would have doubled the cost of this film just to get clearances.
It made no sense. So you're allowed to use that archive as long as you don't charge people to see the film?
You're right. But just so you know, I purposely chose art and music that was, in my estimation, public domain. But I'm not a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't be the final word saying, oh, yeah, that's clear, free mm-hmm. and clear. I just don't have the money to or the knowledge to search out every image and every song.
Before you talked about people potentially being offended, I think we've, culturally, we've seen a lot of films come through that are, kind of similar in the sense of they're kind of taking pretty controversial people mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. characters or figures and stories and making a parody of them. And even what's that, the Broadway musical about, it's on Broadway,
the producers?
It was Trey and Sloan Parker.
Oh, yeah.
What?
Book of Mormon. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, thanks. See, you've earned your keep already. It's a pretty good job. I think as a society, we've come a long way, mm-hmm. And also there's this idea of enough time going by since the Holocaust,
right,
World War
II,
perhaps.
But
of course, there would still be professional grumps. But what about the other side? People that embrace it a little too enthusiastically. That could be too.
Oh, I don't think that would happen. It's a wacky.
It's a wacky, crazy film.
It's
nutty.
Just a bizarre comedy.
It is. I know.
Yeah.
But there are those people that actually support Trump. The same reason, and we would have called him wacky also before. Now it's like, even he's like, I didn't really think this was going to happen.
That's true. That was just dumb luck, because I wrote this film 2 years ago and made it about a year ago, and that was way before Trump got involved in the election. So I don't know if that's a happy accident or a bad accident, but it just turned out that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope people will see the parallels between the two. As you know, Trump came from an entertainment background with the Miss America show and the reality show.
And his hairpiece.
Thank you. Yeah. So there is that similarity, but that was just pure accident.
No, I understand. But what's the term when you're going through stumping, I don't remember, in New Hampshire or wherever, and he was sort of encouraging. He said it's too bad, like, certain generals didn't defy the president's, the commander chief's orders and, you know, and invade ISIS and this and that. So he's actually condoning it. It was, this idea. So there is he definitely has a fascist streak. I don't know how committed he is to it. But
no, I agree. I totally agree.
I know because when the last time we spoke, you have a history with Disney. And here you were trying to do with the Disney, because it comes up throughout the whole thing. The main character, this duck, is obviously a take on a Donald Duck, just maybe a more unseemly version of Donald Duck, if possible.
So what's your question?
It was more of just an observation, I guess.
Well,
not really a good question.
Actually, I think everybody in the entertainment business is influenced by Disney. He influenced so many people, and me particularly. I mean, and so there is a little bit of me in the film. Mm-hmm. Growing up doing drawings all the time, drawing people, drawing friends, doing little flip books, trying to make animated films. You know, it's a little bit autobiographical history there. But Disney is, I try to keep him very minimal in terms of the character in the film. I don't want to tempt the lawyers at Disney with lawsuits. So I try to keep it more based in Europe and sort of European. More
and it's
of
the
European.
Vintage. It's it's actually the 1930s. Disney period where Disney was alive. Disney was around.
That's true. That's
true. What do you think Walt Disney would make of this story?
You know, that's a good question. That's a really good question. I think he has. I think Disney has a sense of humor. I mean, if someone made this film about me, I would be honored.
Mm-hmm.
I would be amused. Mm-hmm. I think it's a funny story. You know, I grew up doing a lot of cartoons for National Lampoon, and they're always trying to push the barriers of good taste and offensiveness and try to scandalize people. And I think that's a wonderful personality for a cartoonist to have that style of art. And so I think Disney would appreciate it. I mean, he worked with Salvador Dali, who also scandalized people and pushed people's buttons. And so I think Walt would applaud it.
You did animation for National Lampoon?
Animation, cartoons.
It's cartoons.
Little print cartoons.
For the magazine.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because I was like, where would they?
And in fact, they compilation, a book compilation of all their cartoons, and they called it Hitler's Favorite Cartoons. So that may have been subconsciously where I came up
not
with
anymore.
The idea, too.
Yeah, right. You should keep it buried there. That's where it belongs. I remember clearly buy this magazine or we'll shoot this dog.
Yes,
it's like a little puppy or something like that.
Wasn't very it? Offensive. Was yeah, it? Exactly. Yeah. We'll shoot this dog. Yeah.
We'll shoot this.
That's a Lampoon.
Yeah.
And so I come from that background of humor, the dark humor, spawned by Charles Adams, the Adams family. I mean, he always had humor about pain and suffering and death and just crazy violence and I always thought that was a funny source of humor. I was never a Peanuts fan or anybody like that. I like to do stuff that was scathing and dark and a bit painful. And I ask people when they come to work for me, are you easily offended? Because I don't do Pixar kind of cartoons here. And they all say, we like pushing the edge and making things a little more provocative.
Sure.
And unfortunately, three of my employees who agreed to that, they refused to work on the film.
Oh, that's right. I did read of that in your notes.
They thought that Hitler was just going too far.
Hmm. Can I ask, does it matter? I guess it doesn't matter if they were Jewish. I was going to ask you if they were Jewish. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I don't think they were. One of them may have been. I don't know. But also, you're right. It doesn't matter.
Also, they were killing a lot of people other than Jews anyway. So.
Yeah, that's true.
You mentioned Charles Adams, and I was wondering, do you know roughly when he died?
It was 60s or 70s.
Oh,
I
it
think.
Was that long ago?
Yeah.
I was going to ask you if you had met him, but I don't think
maybe the 80s, yeah.
Then you're probably too young.
I never met him. No, yeah. I would have liked to. I mean, he was one of my heroes. Him and Disney, what a strange combination, huh?
Sort of. But if you look at those early Disneys, there was a...
Yeah, they're very macabre.
Yeah, there are some macabre, and certainly there's a...
Yeah, skeleton dance. I mean, it's all about these dead people dancing. Yeah,
right.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, again, we'll mention Hitler's Folly, which is a mockumentary.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a mockumentary.
But also, right, which is also, in its way, I think it also... celebrates animation in a very sly way, I suppose you could say. And one of the actors, of course, I wanted to mention, who plays Josh, who's, I guess you could say, you know, the guy who's sort of narrating. Not sort of, he's narrating.
He is.
He is narrating, and he's played by the actor, son of a bitch.
Dana Ashbrook.
Dana Ashbrook.
It's on the top.
Oh, it's up there, of course,
yeah,
where it belongs.
The actor's on the top.
Dana Ashbrook, who many people, of course, know because he played Bobby Briggs on the iconic Twin Peaks, and which is coming back next year.
I heard, yeah. I talked to Dana about it. He says it's going well. He says there's so many actors in it, though. I mean, they're trying to bring everybody back for one last show.
It's
so
amazing.
It's and he's bringing some other actors, some of David's other famous actors in there too.
Is that
so
true?
It's going to be oh yeah.
So it's going to be pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's going to be a blockbuster.
Speaking of which, have you explored doing a series?
I have one in mind. I would like to do, but for most of my career, I prefer doing the shorts and the features. But this idea is really good. It's called Tiffany the Whale, and it's about a whale who wants to be a high fashion model.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's totally absurd, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I've done a pilot. Now, whenever I go around showing my films, I show this pilot and people flip over it. So at some point I'd like to, get some funding because it's very expensive doing a series. I can't finance it myself. So that's something I'm hoping to do in the future.
It's animated?
It's animated, yes.
Okay.
It's very simple animation too. Very clean and
yeah.
Simple.
Well, there was something recent on HBO called Animals. I don't know.
I didn't like it at all.
I didn't see it.
It was not funny. It was not funny.
It has to be funny.
I don't know how they. I don't know how they got on HBO, but they did.
Duplass.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's it. If I had my name Duplass, I'd probably get on.
I think the Plimpton name is probably gets you in the room anyway.
Well, thank you for saying that. Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure. And who else is in it?
Michael Sullivan.
Michael Sullivan, who is, I think you referred to at the beginning, somebody who you worked with previously. Right?
No, we've been friends for a long time. He does animation. He's a wonderful animator.
Oh, okay.
And when you go inside the apartment that's full of junk,
yeah,
that's actually his apartment.
We didn't
move a thing. I don't know how
he shot it around the corner.
It's just
running
down the street here.
Yeah,
I don't know how he dusts the place, but he likes it there. But he's a wonderful animator and an actor too. He was in Greaser's Palace, Robert Downey film.
Right.
So
they're by the way doing a retrospective of Robert Downey.
Where
at? I want to say Film Forum.
Oh wow! I'd love to see Greaser's Palace on the big screen.
Yeah,
that would be very cool.
Yeah, it's soon. Yeah. He did my show too.
Really?
In his apartment.
Mike Sullivan.
No.
Oh, Robert Downey.
Robert Downey, senior. I always start. I'll say
senior.
Robert Downey did my show.
Yeah.
He will say what? And I'll say senior, which I'm more excited about. But I don't know if necessarily anybody else knows who he is.
That's funny. Michael Sullivan had a birthday about 8 years ago, 10 years ago. And Robert Downey Jr. was there.
Oh, really?
And this is before the...
Iron Man,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was still sort of coming back from prison. I forget why he's in prison, drugs or something. And
That's a good way to describe it, drugs or something.
Yeah.
I think it was always drugs.
And he was just starting to make his comeback.
Right.
And then,
I'll say.
He's such a great actor. He's a really nice guy, too, really.
Yeah, I just...
Can't say anything bad about
him.
Well,
I'm sure. Well, he's, it's an interesting conversation I had with Downey, too, because, he touches on a little bit, but more of himself as a young father.
Yeah.
And maybe how he failed in some ways, but, we didn't discuss it in length.
Yeah, right.
Certainly, he's had a long time to repair things.
Right. So Michael knew everybody. Yeah, he knew all those guys
from
back then.
He seems like a real character. So,
and then we have Nate Steinwax, who plays Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, there's some new ersatz archive.
Right. I have Hitler showing the storyboards. mm-hmm. which is a cliche in the animation business. They put storyboards on a wall, and you take a big pointer and you point the story like mm-hmm. that. And we had to scratch it and make it look old, and you know, have it the color sort of disappearing and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It was fun, really fun.
Well, thank you for entertaining us here and letting us come in and talk to you again.
Good.
We'll do it next time when you have something else, or just you know, I'm out of, I got a studio on the east side. I don't know. If you schlep over to East Village ever.
I could do that. I love the East Village.
Yeah.
Great restaurants.
True. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Talk to you again.
I'll give you a drawing. Would you like a drawing?
Would I? Sure.
Downy Duck.
Yeah. That would be great. Thank you.
Can I put this down?
Sure. Okay. Yeah. It's. Yeah. For listening to the podcast, everybody, subscribe on iTunes. You know, all of us podcasters, we implore you to go to iTunes and leave a star rating and a nice comment, because it really does effectively move our little podcast further up the pyramid, you know. So if everybody listening would just do that, I would have an easier time of it, you know. What I ask you to do is go to iTunes and if you're not a subscriber and you do enjoy what you're listening to, go out of your way, go into iTunes, go to the store, and just put in the search field Film Wax, and the show will come up, and you can click on the show, and then it'll give you an area which to do things like leave a comment or star rating, etc. But subscribing, first and foremost, is a wonderful way to keep the shows coming to you. You can like us on Facebook. That's easy enough. We're at facebook.com/filmwaxradio. And, of course, we're on Twitter at filmwaxradio. And we're on Instagram at filmwaxradio as well. So stay in touch with me and let me know what you're doing. And it's been a pleasure. We have another show coming right up in a few days. We have a show coming up with the filmmakers behind the seminal short documentary called Heavy Metal Parking Lot. It's enjoying its 30th anniversary. They're going to have a 30th anniversary screening at Anthology Film Archives next week, and you should go to that. And Jeff Krulik and John Hine, who will be on the show, will be also coming in from Rhode Island and going to appear at their screening at Anthology Film Archives in the East Village. And then they're also having some big exhibition, which they'll talk about in I think it's in Baltimore, but it's at a museum. They're doing a big gallery exhibit of photographs from the Heavy Metal Parking Lot. And so you can go to their website and check all that information out. But in the meantime, next week we'll have Jeff Krulik and John Hine. We might do a second episode because we have so much wonderful content. We have I just did a day in the studio with my producer, Alex Brazell, where we had on a host of people, friends of the podcast. It was like a old home week or something like that, you know, at the studio. We had on Joel Fendelman, who's a friend of the podcast. This is Joel's second appearance. His producer on this particular new film he has is Frank Hall Green. Frank Hall Green was on some time ago when he directed a film called Wildlike. So they were on. And then I had on Josh Bishop, who's a friend of the podcast, and he's returning. And then we had Michelle Negroponte on the show recording a segment. And that came out wonderfully. It was like nice. I was just sitting in the studio and people showed up and talked with me. How much better does it get than that? Not much better. Anyway, this is what I'm trying to put together. Just bring in people into the studio, talk, and have a great time. Hopefully you'll enjoy the show. You may feel little shifts and changes in the show, but it's the heart and the soul of the show is unchanged. It's all about the wax. Thank you for listening. This has been episode number 355 of Film Wax Radio, part of the Showbiz Studios podcast network and presented by Rooftop Films. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, take care. While I astrally project myself into the life of someone else, while I astrally project myself into the life of someone else, while I astrally project myself into the life of someone else, while I astrally project myself into the life of someone else.